Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'natan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai notein haTorah. Amen. Because we're going to be talking about the upcoming month of Elul and the 40 days that are going to start, we probably won't be working so much from the Chumash other than one section that talks about, just I just thought of this right now, that we could add into it. And that's on page 1005. And we're going to look at verse 23. And this is a review of the laws of Kashrut, but we're not going to really be talking about Kashrut. We're going to be talking about verse 23. So who would like to begin and read verse 23? Jan, I just volunteered you. Yes.
Only be strong not to eat the blood, for the blood, it is the life, and you shall not eat the life with the meat.
Okay. This is a prohibition against eating blood. And it's the only part of the prohibitions that are included in all of the laws of Kashrut, where it says to rak chazak, only be strong not to eat the blood. That's what it's singling out. Now, what does that mean to you? Of why you would have to be told to be strong and not eat blood? Okay, and there were some kind of unusual, like, sects of places. Generally, people didn't eat blood and found it pretty revolting. So, I mean, they wouldn't necessarily have something koshered in any way, but they wouldn't be looking to have blood. There were some religious things in ancient civilizations where to eat the blood of something you thought you got the strength of the animal that you were eating the blood of. But generally, if someone said, "Do you want some blood?" You wouldn't necessarily, like now, you know, mixing milk and meat, that seems like, okay, maybe I need to have more strength, spiritual strength, to not do that. But like to really strengthen yourself to not have blood. So that seems a little counterintuitive to us, especially since this is addressed to Jewish people who are already never, ever had an inclination to eat blood, ever. So that even was not even on their radar screen at all. So I heard an interesting observation about that commentary, which said that one would think, well, I'm not going to be eating blood anyway, so why would I have to strengthen myself? But it's to tell us that even for something that is not even on our radar screen to really consider doing in any case, we still have to exercise some strength. Because when we live around people who do things, even to us, if it seems pretty abhorrent or naturally revolting anyway, we are still likely to be influenced by that. We could say, ooh, yuck. And then the little part of our mind is like, I wonder what it tastes like. Or maybe they're onto something. If everybody's doing it, maybe I'm missing out. Maybe I'm making a mistake. And I might kind of start loosening. So even something that is revolting, it has this duality. Just because something is revolting to us, we think, like, I would never do that. But if you live amongst people who are, that's exactly what they're doing, pretty soon the barrier comes down and we're influenced. Like, they seem like perfectly nice people. You know, they're so polite. They're so whatever. So they eat blood. But I could go to their party and not eat the blood. I'll just, you know, eat vegetarian or whatever. And then after a while, I'll be like, well, you know, I want to join in. I don't want to be an outsider in this group. So I'll have a little blood. I'll just have a polite, what in my family used to be called a no thank you helping, which meant you loathed it, but we had to try it anyway. So we always had to have no thank you helpings of something. I'll just have a little bit of blood to be polite and fit in, but it's not like I'm going to, like, enjoy it. And then it's like, well, there seem to be getting something out of it. I think, why not? So that is the nature of the human psyche, is to be drawn towards things that we think we are revolted by, but in the end, we can actually come to it pretty easily. You can see in the laws of Kashrut, the Jewish people all used to follow the laws of Kashrut. It was a given. It was one of the premises of definitions of someone who was Jewish, was someone who kept kosher, and someone, like, that was fundamental, even for people who didn't do other things. If you take a survey of people today, you won't necessarily find that at all. So how did that happen? It only happened because our living with other people kind of drew us off course on that. And where people would never consider it, they started considering it until it became like totally mainstream, and it was like not a big deal at all. And not even any, like, I feel embarrassed about it, but I just do it like in private, like when people do things that they know are not acceptable, but they still have a yearning for it, and they kind of go underground with it. Now it's common, you know, oh, let's go here or there and eat whatever and eat whatever, and people don't think anything of it, and think that people who do observe the laws of kashrut are kind of intense. You know, that is, you know, it's like, you know, like, wow, that's pretty intense. Yeah, intense. So things can change even when we think they can't. So they could. So it starts off with this rak chazak. Be extra strong in things that you think that you have a natural avoidance of. Like, I have to say, when I smell bacon cooking, I just get like kind of nauseous, you know, because I never had it. I grew up with it, you know, all my friends, and we lived in an apartment building where, when we got married, the people across the hall, I'm telling you, they must have had bacon every Sunday morning. And it just, you know, stuck, the smell of it just kind of hung in the hall. I just felt even embarrassed that we lived across the way from them, that anyone might think that that was coming from our house, in addition to walking out and just being overwhelmed with the smell of it. So that would actually be something that I would have to have more chazak. I would have to have more strength to not fall into, because I think I have a natural aversion to it. And when you think you have a natural aversion, you can actually come to it, whereas something else may not be. And on the other hand, we can also say, if we have to be strong about something we have an aversion to, how much stronger do we have to be to something that we are okay with, and it's hard for us to withhold, to restrain ourselves. So this is considered not really just about not eating blood, but really about all of the mitzvot. So when we talk about this, this dovetails very nicely with the 40 days of teshuva, of repentance, that we're going to start on Shabbos when we have the Rosh Chodesh of the month of Elul. Yes?
You know, I read that some Christian religion, I guess the Jehovah's Witness, I'm not sure, they misinterpret this to think they can't have a blood transfusion.
Oh.
And
that's interesting.
So, well, I think now scientists are working on some artificial blood to use for transfusions in people that won't allow a blood transfusion.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's interesting, people always have the question, too, about using a pig heart valve, which they use, like that's somehow not kosher. It's like, unless you're eating your heart, you know, you don't have to worry about it, and it's about eating it. It's not about using it. So you're totally free. The most, whatever, righteous Jewish person in the world would take a pig valve if that was going to be the better choice for them. But people always say, well, how come then you could be losing your life because you can't have a pig valve? So you can. So God willing, you won't need a valve. And if you do and a pig valve becomes available, go for it. So when we talk about all of the mitzvot, what we're going to be talking about during the days of Teshuvah that are starting with Rosh Chodesh Elul is repenting, that word I don't really like, returning back, correcting our errors. And all errors, whether they seem their mitzvot or not, are. So if it's a sin between a person and another person, you say, well, that's different. Like, I'll just confess to God. And that's actually much easier than confessing to the person you hurt and to try to correct it. So, but that's all in the same boat, and God doesn't even forgive us for our sins between us and other people on Yom Kippur at all, unless we have appeased the person who we have offended. So if we think that we can kind of skirt the system and God, well, I'll just take care of my issue with so-and-so by going to God, it's like, not going to work. And any sin that we have between us and another person is also considered a sin against God, because that person is God's child. And I remember when somebody offended one of my children, it never happened, but it wasn't enough to me that they made up. I was still seething afterwards, and I was like, what's wrong with this kid? So, you know, then of course they're roommates or whatever. So they worked it all out. But it's an offense against me. Honestly, the person should really apologize to my husband and me as well, because they offended my child. So, and I take that very seriously. So that's the same idea as with God and our offenses between people, ourselves and others. But I want to talk about this 40 days of Teshuvah. First of all, the number 40 is associated with transformation. It's how many days it takes to go through a process and really reach a final transformation, which is why Yom Kippur is on the 40th day. So it starts off, if it wouldn't be Shabbos, we'd be blowing the shofar every morning starting with Rosh Chodesh Elul. Because of the way it falls out, we won't be starting it until Sunday morning. It will be the first time the shofar is blown. And that shofar is supposed to be a wake-up call. Time is getting short. It's time to go. Get ready. Start the process so you'll be ready by Yom Kippur. And we intensify. Then we have the 10 days of Teshuvah between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But they really start starting on Shabbos. So this past week at our shul, we had a guest lecture, Rabbi and Rebbetzin, who came in. And the Rebbetzin spoke about Harry Potter and doing Teshuvah. So I wanted to share that with you because we all really enjoyed it, and I thought it would be interesting to share. So I emailed the rabbi, who's now like traveling through, I don't know, Colorado or South Dakota or someplace before returning to Israel, and said, can I have your notes from the class? So he forwarded them to me. So it starts out, and maybe more of you are familiar with Harry Potter than I am, so you can fill in the blanks that were just that I only superficially got those things. But it talks about Harry Potter, and we know Harry Potter. What's his ranking of wizards? Where is he in the wizard?
That is a question. I was on the first movie.
It's still being developed, but he's one of the most powerful wizards.
Exactly. He's the one of the most powerful wizards. He is not the smartest wizard, but he is the most powerful wizard. When he first goes to wizard school, the wizard he goes to, or the school that he goes to, he's in the class for the wizards that have a dark side to them. So he has a streak, an evil streak in him. And it gets channeled and allows him actually to be the most powerful of the... Are you shaking your head now?
Yeah, I'm shaking my head now.
Why?
Because he goes into the class with a lot of the learned students, and he turns down the school, the class that has the dark evil side, and he doesn't know why he turns it down.
Oh, that's very interesting. That's exactly opposite.
You have to get into the fourth or fifth book before you find out why.
Okay. Is it because he had an evil past and he was trying to get rid of it?
Because when the man who killed his parents, Valdemar, tried to kill Harry Potter, he put a bit of his soul inside the baby who lived.
And the baby who lived was?
Harry Potter.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying.
But Harry Potter never knew he had an evil soul.
Oh, he didn't know.
No, he didn't know. He knew he'd get mad and could do things.
Exactly.
But he didn't know why.
That's so exactly what you're
and
saying?
If you would like to see the tapes, the CDs, I'll bring them.
Thank you. Okay, that'll be my 40 days of Teshuvah. I'll be looking at Harry Potter.
8 hours of solid watching.
I'm not sure I have 8 hours of solid watching time, but I can try.
Tapes.
Okay, so anyway, he has this evil in him, which is really is the same thing as a Yetzer Hara. And people have different levels of Yetzer Hara, of evil inclinations. And so some people get blown off track, or they know that they have an inclination to something that could frighten them. And it could frighten them because they're afraid of what they can do and they want to dismiss that from their psyche. But he becomes one of the most powerful, and his power actually comes from that very evil that was put into him. So the fact that he could do, and he knows he could do something very bad, makes himself powerful. So we're going to find out why, because the Talmud talks about this way long before Harry Potter. So the truth is if we want to be our most powerful selves, we need to know and be okay with the fact at a certain level, we'll talk about how this develops, with the evil that we could do or that we have done that we are trying to do teshuvah over. So you would think that we would want to say, just get this inclination out of me. Just take, if you could be exercised, get it out. And the prophets, the sages of the past during the time before the Talmud, they tried davening, praying to God, fasting over, like, take away this Yetzer Hara, take it away, look at what people bring themselves to, such ruination, and they get into idol worship, and they get into all sorts, the three, you know, major sins of sexual immorality, idolatry, and murder. It's like, people who know that they can do that, or they have done that, or any other grave sin, most people would think, like, I just want that to be extracted from me, like, get rid of this so I can be a holy person. It says, that's not the answer. So we're going to talk about a rabbi whose name was Rabbi Reish Lakish, and he was at the time of the Talmud. And he actually makes comments about a person like himself, which is a Harry Potter-like person, but he actually did the things that he carried out. He started off as a great sage, and then he went, as they say in the religious world, OTD, which means off the derech, off the path. He went off. And he became a burglar, a womanizer, and all-round scoundrel. And that's who he was. So, the time of the Talmud, like in the, after the, before the destruction of the first temple.
And what was the rabbi's name?
Reish Lakish. So, Rabbi Reish Lakish said, "Great is repentance because it transforms premeditated sins into inadvertent transgressions." But he also said, "Great is repentance because it transforms premeditated sins into merits. There is no difficulty, and we're going to see why." So what helps a teshuva process transform intentional sin into unintentional sin? Kind of lowers the level of it, takes it down, like plea bargains it down to a lower charge. And why can you have a premeditated sin turn into into a merit, as a merit to you, not even just like neutral, but actually add to you. So he talks about what happened with Reish Lakish. So it says, Reish Lakish, as he is known, is one of the most brilliant and famous rabbis in the Talmud, not just like some nice guy. We first hear of him in Masechet Bava Metzia, which is irrelevant for us. One day the Talmud says, Rabbi Yochanan was bathing in the Jordan River. All of a sudden, Reish Lakish, who was a bandit, jumped in to attack him. Rabbi Yochanan, it says, was a gorgeous man. Saying he's like a hunk is kind of disrespectful, but it said that people, men and women alike, would swoon when they even saw his forearm. They would just, it'd be like, oh my gosh, like, he is so gorgeous. So, Rabbi Yochanan says to him, to the powerful man, "Your strength should be devoted to Torah." Reish Lakish replied to the handsome rabbi, "Your beauty should be devoted to women." Rabbi Yochanan said, "If you return, if you do teshuva, I will let you marry my sister, who is even more beautiful than me." So never mind what we think about the brother offering his sister, but it's a big incentive plan for him. Reish Lakish began to do teshuva, to repent, and Rabbi Yochanan taught him Torah, and he became a great sage. So that he redirected all of his strength. So what happens is, and why his comments that great is repentance because it transforms premeditated sins into merits, and premeditated sins into inadvertent sins, and he also said that repentance transforms premeditated sins into merits. So he said, first of all, what is he talking about, and why does he say it? It's like, he can say it because it was his own personal experience. So it said as soon as he started doing teshuva, he lost his physical strength. So it said not only was he a bandit, but it says like he could jump across rivers. So I know this sounds like hyperbole. I'm not sure whether he was jumping across rivers, but as soon as he started to do teshuva, he couldn't jump across the rivers anymore. So it says the challenge of doing teshuva is when we lessen our connection to evil, we actually also lessen our connection. If we're trying to put it out of us all completely and get rid of it, we lose our vitality, our strength for good as well. We just become like our life force diminishes. So it gives the parables or the parable that somebody who has cancer and is undergoing, whether it's radiation or chemotherapy, it doesn't just get rid of the cancer, it also depletes and diminishes the life force as well. So it brings everything down. So we don't want that to happen. So we actually want to hold on to the inclination to evil. In a way, it would be like saying, well, we need to hold on to some of the cancer in some way and just redirect those cells in a different direction. Medicine hasn't figured out how to do that, but in the world of the spirit, it can be done. So it says, so what happens? What's the difference? It says, a person who is so mortified by what they've done, first of all, they come to understand that they've done something that's wrong. Again, they may want to just have it go away, go off their, you know, CV, not be identified with them at all. What's interesting is Rish Lakish never hides the fact that he was a bandit. It's not, you know, it wouldn't be nice to say, oh, so you were a bandit in your past. Nobody would say that to him, but he didn't try to get it off the records. Everyone knows that, and it's been written about publicly lots of places. So you'd think that he would think like, oh, not only was I a bandit, which is terrible, but now everybody knows I was a bandit for eternity because it's preserved in the Talmud. So if he wanted to be rid of it completely, it says that then his sins would be wiped away and it would be clear, but all of the emotional, physical, psychic energy that was associated with that sin would also be taken away from him. So he would be just kind of returned to his former self, but he would never be greater. Susan?
He would also be less of an inspiration.
He would also be less of an inspiration, and he could not become as great as a man. So it says that a person who does teshuvah, and we'll talk about what the difference is, stands in a place that the most righteous person cannot stand. Because to be, okay, so you're righteous, that's wonderful and beautiful, but there's something more significant about being transformed from overcoming it and keeping it in front of your eyes always as a motivation for you to become greater and greater. So for example, King David says, my sin is before my eyes always. You know, some people would say, maybe some sort of a therapist would say, no, you need to get rid of it and move beyond it and put it out of your mind. And we're saying, no, don't ever put it out of your mind, because it has the potential to inspire you to take, to do the opposite and to strengthen yourself, particularly in that area, and to grow above and beyond what you were there before. So the Rebbetzin was kind of funny. She says, I'm not advising between now and Yom Kippur to go out and do something horrific and then do teshuva on it so you can become ever greater. That's not really the point. But what is interesting is that it does open up an incentive to find in ourselves all the wrong things we've done instead of not wanting to see them and ignoring it or not acknowledging it. It says, by finding it, we can then catch the energy of it and redirect it. And that will transform us. Susan?
Is it kind of like AA, no matter how many years you've been sober, every week you go and say, I'm an alcoholic?
That's right. You say that and you keep that. If you like want to put that out of your mind, you're going to find yourself with a drink in your hand. Okay, so if you keep that in front of you always, I am a recovering alcoholic. That is my weakness. I need to remember that every minute of the day. And as soon as I think, as some people, when they fall off the wagon, they'll say, I didn't think that just one little, you know, l'chaim would do anything. And then pretty soon, there they are. It says, unless it has to be a complete, total focus. So when does that happen? So one is called teshuvah meyira. Of teshuvah...
Sorry.
Nice music. Teshuva that comes from Yira, from a sense of fear and awe and regret, revulsion about myself, that I could do something. I'm trying to get rid of it as much as possible, so I do teshuva. But then I only return to what I was. And that is incomplete teshuva. Complete teshuva. I'm sorry?
You said Yira. What is Yira?
Yira means, awe of God. Yira, like Yirat Shamayim is someone who has what's called fear of heaven or awe of God. But that also means that they're, in a way, they're awed in a negative way about themselves. It's like, ugh, I'm so disgusting. I can't believe I did that. Like, it was so wrong. And so I'll correct it, but it's more from, like, avoidance. I'm going to avoid that at all costs. The person, says, who comes from a place of ahava, of love, transforms in a different way. Transforms is like, I want to be close to God. I want to be returned to myself. I want to use the energy I used to do the wrong thing, to make the mistake. I want to direct it and channel that energy, not wipe it out. I want to channel that energy because it's a tremendous force. People who are doing things that are wrong usually put a lot of energy into it, and they find the enthusiasm for it. That's the other thing, is where people are doing things that are wrong are really pretty enthusiastic about what they're doing because there's a desire or a drive for it. Trying to do good sometimes, we're like a little bit more lackadaisical or more lethargic and kind of, it's hard, but to go off and do something, you know, if kids are going out and joyriding or something, they don't get in the car and go 20 miles an hour. You're like, oh, okay, in the car. You know, they're like, I'm out there, and like, you know, let's party. So that is the enthusiasm that goes with things that are negative that we do. It's because we get such a thrill out of it, and that it's doing something for us. So the goal is not to wipe it out, but to rechannel and redirect and keep that thing that we did in front of our eyes always as a motivation. It's because I want to not only in love for God come back to be in relationship there and bridge the gaps or the distance that I've created, but I want to do this and love myself. And I love myself and I love what's called my koach. I love the strengths that I have. So you'll see the teachers will say that about kids, you know, who are in school, who are like the troublemaker kids. One kind of teacher would want to, like, get this kid out of my class. Another kind of teacher would be like, now there's a lot of strengths to channel. So, and, you know, teachers will say, you have a lot of leadership potential. Because I see that when you go off, you know, doing things that are, you know, distracting, destructive, or whatever, everyone's following you. That means you're a leader. Or that means you have a lot of energy. You have a lot of enthusiasm. So I don't want to smash this person. I want to say, wow, you have a lot of strength. Let's direct it this way. Get that person who's, you know, jumping out of their chair to lead the, I don't know, the rah-rah team or something. Like, they have a lot of energy to jump around and do things and be funny and say things that teachers hate in the middle of the classroom. Mm-hmm. So that's what we want to do for ourselves. And so that becomes an expression of love of God as well as, more importantly, love of myself. And so my teshuvah is complete because I'm not taking off part of my soul. I'm not dismissing part of my energy in order to move forward. So this is what Rish Lakish is saying because of his own personal experience is, I know because I did it, that a person who does teshuva and has their premeditated sins turn into inadvertent transgressions, that's someone who has done teshuva from yira, from awe alone. And we'd be happy if people did that. But the person would be deficient and the world would be deficient because that person has not chosen the other path, which is teshuvah from ahava, from love, where I'm coming from a love of God and a love of my complete self. Like all my warts or all my everything is like, I have a koach. So I heard somebody who had a child who's just kind of a wild kid. And not wild, that's not fair. Just can be strong-willed, okay? So strong-will can be really good or it can be really bad. So instead of saying, oh, this kid is driving me crazy, he just says, she has a lot of strength. She has a lot of strength and strong will, and it will serve her well if it's channeled in the right direction. And if it's not channeled in the right direction, it can be very destructive or just be neutral. So the idea is that we want to channel that and love ourselves and love our strengths and stand almost proudly, because we better be able to find our strengths and we better be able to know what we can use and what we can channel. So in the Shema, when we say, V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha, with all of our heart. So the wording is not all of my heart, it's all of my hearts, is really the Hebrew, is all of my hearts. And the heart is associated with our ratzon, what we want to do. Our will is in our hearts. So it says the reason it's two hearts is we have two wills. We have the will to do good and we have the will to do evil and to make mistakes. If we don't serve God with both of our hearts, we're not really serving God. So we have to find ways to channel the things that are our inclinations to do wrong and, you know, learn about those mitzvot that go along with whatever it is. Like if somebody who has an inclination for sexual promiscuity, they just do. That's just like their thing. That's their thing. So that's a person, and especially if they have sinned with that, they need to dedicate themselves to being especially on guard for those opportunities. Learn the laws of, for example, of SNEAs, of privacy, of not secluding themselves with a person of the opposite gender who they are not married to, of not touching anybody of the opposite sex, those things. So some people say, I do that, it doesn't do anything for me. So some rabbis would say, you have a worse problem. If it doesn't do anything for you to touch somebody, then that's a real problem. That means you're not alive. So a person who has that as their inclination, that's what they should focus on so that they can use that inclination, but to use it to become more sensitized. A person who maybe is inclined to steal. You know, their jealousy and their desire for money leads them to do things that are unethical or illegal in the monetary world. That person needs to learn about that and learn how to be scrupulous in their money, how they get it, how they use it, where they give it. That person has to do that, to focus on that. So everyone has, there's a corresponding mitzvah that goes along as the antidote for whatever the inclination is that the person needs to become extra firm in. Now, ideally, it'd be nice if everybody was doing everything perfectly, but nobody's doing everything perfectly. So the idea is to focus on the thing that we know is our trap, you know, our pothole in our spiritual life. Everybody has something different that appeals to them. So, Patricia.
Could you give an example of
inadvertent sin?
Yeah, so because he was saying that if you do teshuva out of fear of God, it leads to inadvertent transgressions.
No, what it's saying is your intentional sins are transformed into unintentional sins. So they get downgraded in their severity.
Okay.
So everything gets lessened. But a person who does teshuva out of love
changes.
Not only does it become completely like whited out, covered over, it becomes an actual merit. It gets added to the plus column of your life because it's taking you into an elevated level. Anytime we transform a dark place into a light place, that gives us merit. If we just negate we just stop doing the negative because of our teshuva, that's okay. So we'll give you credit for that in that it'll be, you'll get it like, what's the word? Not a demotion, because that sounds bad. It'll go down in severity of what you've done, but it's not going to add any merit to you because it's not as beneficial. The mistakes are meant to be transformed into merits through doing teshuva, through love, and using the energy that went into the sin to become improved as opposed to just neutralized. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
yes?
Along those lines, your example with someone who is sexually promiscuous, just because if they don't put themselves in that situation, it seems to me like they're not going to transform. They're just like taking away the temptation. So the real transformation would take place if they have the wherewithal or whatever to be around, you know, somebody of the opposite sex and not have those feelings.
That's actually not the expectation. The expectation is that you will have those feelings always, because that's part of your inclination. And what are you going to do, knowing that that's a pit for you, and learning the mitzvot that go along with it, that is considered, and following them, that is considered a transformation. Because it's not that you want to be transformed to not have the desire, because that is saying, I don't want to even have the desire. So that's not good.
Have the desire, but not act upon it.
Okay, so to have the desire but not act upon it is just brings you to a neutral place. That's one level of righteousness. But there is another level by intensifying by intensifying your commitment to the mitzvot, learning about them, applying them, that will raise you to a higher level, because maybe it's not that you're trying to not ever have the temptation, just like the person who's an alcoholic. They are not going to be at a place where they no longer have the temptation. It may be kind of undercover for a little bit, but if one little thing, they'll fall into the trap immediately again. So it's not to not have the temptation, it's to say, I do have the temptation. I will always have the temptation because that's how God made me, is with that temptation. But I will do everything I can to follow the laws that are our construct of safety and protection so that I don't fall into the trap again. And I will always have in front of my mind, this is my temptation. Because to say, I don't want to have this temptation. That's when the rabbis, when they were praying that the Yetzer Hara, the temptation for all of this, go away, it said the next day the chickens laid no eggs. It's like all the life force. Having a sexual drive is a good thing. So when it says the chickens didn't lay eggs, it's because you're not going to get, at that time, you didn't get eggs if you had just chickens and hens and no whatever rooster around. So we don't want that, because that's a depletion of the life force. We want it channeled so that it works out, so that it enhances people's lives. Because people think, you see people who, you know, they're working together with someone of the opposite sex, and they're having a meeting at Starbucks, and next thing you know, they're going to, oh, we'll have dinner, you know, and go over the project, and, you know, maybe we need to do such and such, and then pretty soon they're having an affair in the office. Nobody set out to say, oh, let me see if I can have an affair. People are like, I don't know how it happened. It's like, well, how do you think it happened? You know, people should have a sexual desire. We don't want them to not have it. We want it to be channeled appropriately. And then that's the best. So it says, in fact, the greater the person, the greater their Yetzer Hara, the greater their inclination to do wrong. There's a story about a rabbi who was climbing up a ladder, and he had female guests, like up in the attic, who were staying there, and he was going up with the intention of doing something, indulging. And so he caught himself and he started yelling, fire, fire. And so everybody in the house came like, what's the matter? Where's the fire? You know, he's like, in me. I'm like, I'm on my way up to do this, and I figured I needed to rescue myself. This is the fire of my passion is so ablaze, I need to protect myself more. So it's not, oh, it's just the spiritual lowlifes who have this big Yetzer Hara. It's the opposite. If you're kind of a spiritually kind of, average person, you'll have an average Yetzer Hara. The higher you get, the greater your Yetzer Hara, the greater. So like Moshe Rabbeinu, for example, would absolutely never, ever, ever, ever be with another woman, touch her, or be secluded with her, ever. You'd think, oh, he's so spiritual. He would never think of that. It's like, yes, he would. So the drives have to be, everything has to be kept in balance. If you have a strong spiritual level, the counterbalance is going to be a strong level, strong desire to do things that are wrong, and everybody in their own particular way.
I'm just trying to reconcile that with someone who maybe doesn't have that strong. I mean, there are people maybe
that's not their thing.
That's just not their thing.
Right, and it may be. So the truth is, all human beings, if they're alive, are somewhere on the chart where they have to protect themselves. So a person can't say, I just don't have, I'm just not attracted to anybody. And so, unless I feel it immediately, then I know I won't. It's like, you don't know that, and that drive is so essential of a person. It's an extension of the creative, the creative urge, and the bonding urge that God put into all of us. So to say that, it means that either there's something maybe wrong, something not so healthy, or you're in denial and haven't been in the right situation to make it happen. So you'd be surprised. Yes, and then yes.
I don't know how many times in the Dear Amy advice column, the different posts, I've read about people having office affairs, and working together and meeting coffee and all that, or people online.
Yes.
And first,
or on business trips when people feel that different rules apply.
Trips, and they have joining rooms and online too. They're friends with somebody, and then before they know, I just want to meet them.
Yeah.
Just for coffee. And
people's marriages have been destroyed by
that. Emotional affair online.
It's still a betrayal. Yeah. So those things, you have to be really careful. That's why there is so much now. It makes it even easier because our ability to communicate with people. Oh, I think I'll just see. I wonder what my old boyfriend is doing from, you know, high school. And now I'm like in my 60s or whatever. Well, you know, we just kind of caught up for a while. It's like, oh, it would be so great to see you. I have a family member. That's how they ended up getting divorced. Was because the woman contacted a high school boyfriend just to catch up. And then pretty soon it was...
Technically, I thought, I mean, a man and woman who are married are never really supposed to be in a room with the door closed.
That's right. It's called, that's right. You cannot, it's called yichud.
Yeah, and after, I mean, at a wedding, right after the ceremony, the bride and groom go into a room by themselves. And
that's, I mean, should be the first time.
That's supposed to be the first time.
That's right.
Alone.
Right. That's why, you know, people in the religious world have dates in public places. You know, you go to a hotel in Israel, and it's like, shidduch date, old married couple. You know, it's like, that's because they have their dates, and you can just see them, and you just see their comportment. It's like, okay, they're on a date. But that's what they go to hotels usually. And I don't mean hotel rooms. I mean hotel lobbies. Hotel lobbies. Restaurants. Yeah, I had to clarify that. Yeah, they just go to a hotel and, you know, get to know each other. It's like, that came out wrong. So
in the Orthodox world, I mean, you get introduced to somebody, or I guess I mean, I've even heard of people, you know, going on, was it Frumster.com or something?
Frumster.com. It's a Jewish webmaster.
And just have your dates in a kosher restaurant, or just in a lobby, or go to a concert or something.
Right, someplace where you're in public, or a chaperoned area. It's like you don't, says, because the body's inclinations get ahead of the head, and... of our thinking. Joanna?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to like kind of the like concept of like sinning in your thoughts though, because like a few weeks ago when they do the battle against Midian, they like want to make an offering because they feel like there's some commentary like they sinned in their thoughts or something.
Who sinned in their thoughts? The Jewish people?
The officers who went out to
battle.
It's like in one of the commentaries.
Oh, interesting. There is a sin of thought. There are sins of thought.
So I guess, like, against that whole, like, oh, you're never going to get rid of that inclination, whatever the inclination to do it is, aren't you then, like, sinning in your thoughts constantly? So how do you...
You become very conscious about monitoring your thoughts and redirecting them. So it says, we're not responsible for our first thought, but we are responsible for our second thought. So when we engage ourselves, so if, let's say you see a really,
spinning around on that thought. Right?
Yes, you don't feed that thought. Okay. You redirect it. Like if you see somebody, like if you're married, you're a woman, and you see a man who you think is like, wow, you know, he seems really interesting, he's handsome, he's powerful, whatever, and you're like, do you feel that attraction? And it's like, so is my husband. Okay, thank God that God created somebody who's so lovely. I mean, those kinds of things. But that thought that pops into your head, I said, those things are fast. So we're not responsible for our first thought, but we are responsible for our second thought. If we decide to entertain that thought and kind of whatever, like that, we are responsible for.
How do you prevent against like suppressing thoughts then in an unhealthy way if you're constantly doing that?
You focus more on redirection. Suppressing doesn't really work so well anyway. Because as soon as you say, don't think about, even where they say, don't think about pink elephants or something, it's like the only image. I mean, that's actually hard for me to conjure up because I can't even quite picture what a pink elephant would look like. But as soon as you say, don't think about that, we don't say, don't think about that. We say, think about this, something else, and just get it redirected. And we have to then monitor our thoughts. And be aware, like, I tend to kind of daydream and go off on whatever. So some people don't. They just don't. It would take something more. It would take some other thing. But whatever the thought is, a thought of being very wealthy or the thought about if I had this person's whatever, I would be, you know, we start in the thought of coveting. So it's like, and then the antidote to that is focusing on gratitude for what you have. So you don't say, don't think about their mansion. It's like, think about how grateful I am for my home and what it has, and it gives me, you know, pleasure, and I don't have to. I mean, sometimes when all the rain and flooding, I'm like, thank God I have a house. You know, that's, and I'm not sitting outside living under a bridge and getting, you know, flooded. So that just redirects. But if we start saying, well, don't think about that, it guarantees that it's going to stay right front and center in our minds. Eileen, and then Joanna.
Yeah,
that's
so funny how every week you talk about just the perfect thing for my life. I appreciate that.
I'm going out on a limb here and saying it applies to every single person in some way. So
yesterday I had an experience where I felt someone did something very hurtful, really hurtful, right?
Oh.
And I said to that person, I am so hurt and so angry that I really feel like being mean to you. But you have my promise that I will not be mean to you. And so it's exactly what you said, like I embraced the dark, angry hurt, and I made a promise that I wouldn't go there. And it felt great, because it was straight up. It felt great, I just have to say. So I love hearing about this, because it sounds like the same idea. I didn't try to go, oh, that's mean, that's not nice, blah, blah, blah. I acknowledged it, and then I made a promise not to go there.
And I have had a number of occasions to have the same thing where somebody was, you know, very short or snippy or, I don't know, things with me, and I feel like saying, well, my first thought is, well, then I'm never speaking to you again, or I'm going to, like, get back at you, retaliate in some way. And then I think, okay, Hashem gives us all of our situations. This person also has tremendous merits and things that they do great, and this negative side of this person is actually related to the positive side. You know, somebody who is very much on top of things, in control, you know, thinks very fast. Well, sometimes those very people, it's just like people who have a quick sense of humor can also end up being very insulting, because they think so fast, and then something kind of, I don't know what's the word, witty. They're very witty. But those same people can also be people who insult other people very quickly, because their mouth engages before they think really about it. And sometimes it's funny, and sometimes it is really not good. So then there are other people who can't, you know, think or respond. It's like they're so plodding. But you can be sure that person is not going to probably be the person who's going to come out with some quick comeback, because they don't think that fast to even do that. So they're more likely to think about what they say. So that's not their issue. And they can pat themselves on the back that that's not their issue. But then they have something else. Is no option. Is if you're alive, there is some Yetzer Hara, there is some place on the whole plan that we're going to have some place that trips up. It says there's no such thing as a person who is totally righteous and who has never sinned and does not have an inclination. It's not possible. Perfection belongs to God, not to people. By definition, that we're in a body and we're physical, that comes with physical drives, of physical that are connected to emotional or psychological drives. We all have it. And our goal is only to transform that. And it's not meant to be. That's why we don't have an exorcism. We don't ever say, you know, get rid of this part of this person, you know. It's like, let's have a deep meeting and discussion about how that energy can be redirected, how it can become a source of strength to you and to the rest of everyone else. Janice.
So going back to this rabbi.
Yes.
Who started out not being a rabbi, then all of this, and applying it to us, how far back do you go when you're doing this teshuva process? And how far back, you know, like, how did he make amends to the people he robbed and, you know, perhaps marriages he broke up and rivers he jumped over? But, you know, like, to bring up something from 40 years ago or whatever, is that to try and track down somebody so that you can do teshuva? Is that harmful? Is that, you know, like reconnecting, like somebody who's saying, you know, with an old boyfriend.
Right. Can I apologize for how we did that?
Yeah.
So that's actually, there are guidelines for that I'm not totally familiar with, about which things, like of going back to a person, if it would make things worse or better, that other things, there's sometimes you say, oh, you know, it would just be worse if I, you know, called them to say I'm sorry. And usually the answer is, worse for whom? It's like, well, worse actually for me, because I don't really want to confront it. But sometimes it's true that it is better not to go back to a person, either because it will actually reopen the whole connection, or it will be detrimental, or the person doesn't know, and it will actually begin the problem rather than end it. It'll stir it up. So that you have to actually ask advice for. But it's like in AA, where one of the steps is that you have to go back and you have an inventory of And it goes back your whole life. You don't say, oh, well, it's not like there's a, what's it called? Not an expiration date. There's no statute of limitations on errors. Well, that was a long time ago, because you can pretty much bet that if we've hurt someone or done something wrong, they remember. If they know about it, they remember. And it's not clear. We'd like to say, oh, that was, let bygones be bygones. Well, those bygones really aren't bygones. So even if the person, we can't connect with the person directly for one reason or another, we still have to go through some internal process. Even if we do something somewhat, not secretly, but sensitively, let's say we know this person is involved in a certain organization. If it's something legitimate and moral, you know, just making a donation to that organization in that person's honor or whatever, something that you there is some sort of reparation for it. So there is correction. So that's how we do that. But it is your whole life, anything. In fact, it says that we always do teshuva for all of our mistakes, always, because whatever the mistake was means that that is pointing us in the direction that we have a weakness there, and even if it hasn't shown up in some way for 7 years, it's still there, and it's hibernating, and so we still are doing teshuva on mistakes. And we have more regret every time, as we're ascending in our spiritual level, we have even more regret that we used any of our precious time and valuable life energy to do something wrong. So we actually feel it more. The higher we get, we feel more regret about what we've done, hopefully. Jan.
Philosophically, wouldn't you just go back a year, because you have the month of Elul occurs once a year?
It does, but we've become actually more sensitive to what we may have overlooked. And that's part of it, is as we climb, and hopefully that's the direction we're going, climbing to higher levels and become more refined, we actually become retroactively more aware of things that we did that were wrong. So it's a sign of progress that we can have more things on our list that we do. So we may not be there may be more things. There was a story, this was a true story, this happened a little while ago. It wasn't so long. The elapsed time wasn't so long, but it was a rabbi who was going to, in New York, was going to a wedding. And the wedding, he was already running late. And the wedding, parking in New York is terrible. There was one space that was available, and there was somebody else kind of like slowly getting ready to turn in, and he cut her off and pulled in around her and took the space. So there's no place left for her to park. And he's then, of course, they were going to the same wedding, so then he saw her in the wedding and just, you know, kind of ignored her, didn't say anything. And then, I don't know if it was like a year later, 2 years later, he really got to think, because it was still, he still was kind of, it was niggling at him, and he decided he needed to call her. He knew who it was. And he called her to apologize. He said, I just have to tell you, I've really been thinking about it. It's been bothering me for a long time. It's before Yom Kippur. I just wanted to call for being so rude to you and cutting you off at the wedding in the parking lot, because I can't believe I did that. That was so mean and insensitive and rude, and I should have apologized to you right away. But I didn't want to come to Yom Kippur and have that still on me, and I really wanted to apologize to you. So first of all, she was shocked that he called. She knew exactly who it was. She knew it was him. And she said, no one's ever done that. So they had this whole friendly conversation. I forgive you, the whole thing. And a couple years after that, it was either her son and his daughter or whatever, they, through some roundabout way, met each other and wanted to get married. And the mother, I think it was the mother, the woman was the mother of the daughter, and he had the son. And so they got engaged, they were going to get engaged, and she called him and said, I want you to know that if it's only because you called me that we are willing to go ahead with this. She said, because I wouldn't really want my daughter to marry into a family where that was acceptable behavior. So we also never know what the full impact is of our expressions of regret. That would be a case where his teshuva was coming from love and a feeling of you know, I did this, and that it not it changed it to a merit. I mean, that it unlocked that opportunity where it could have been something that had far-reaching consequences. And yet we would think, who's going to remember I cut them off? People always cut people off, especially in New York. You know how New Yorkers are. So he could have satisfied himself with that and figured, you know, okay, next time I'll drive more carefully. But he wouldn't have done it. We're saying, like, this must be, this rudeness is in me. I have to be careful of this, and I want to, even a couple years later, take care of that. So there is no statute of limitations on those things. All right, we will stop for today, but keeping in mind, we shouldn't feel bad. In fact, we should feel good that our Yetzer Hara is there, because it's a source of tremendous energy, a tremendous inspiration, and we want to claim our whole selves. When we do that, we can transform ourselves to a much higher level, not just return back to original status, but to actually go to a highest level. And this is how we understand the whole process. It's not like, oh, well, the big sinners, they should be doing teshuva, and everybody else is probably okay. If your name's not in the paper, I guess I'm fine. So we're not, except it's perfectly fine. We don't believe in sin, again, is like trying to get rid of something. It's to acknowledge it and redirect it and use it. And in that way, we can transform. So God willing, we'll open our 40-day process with enthusiasm, and that we should take that moral inventory and not be discouraged by what we find, but to be glad to know that we have untapped energy that we have not made full use of. So God willing, we can do that. So good Shabbos and a Chodesh Tov. It should be a good and inspiring month for everybody. See you next week.
Thank you.
Good job.